Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past year and a half, we have seen horrific images and videos coming out of Gaza. Over the past few weeks, the images and videos show babies who are skin and bones. People in Gaza are now dying from starvation. One of today's guests, Afik Nasuli, saw this firsthand when he recently went to Gaza. He writes about his experience for The Intercept, reporting that it is a famine that is manufactured and an aid distribution system seemingly designed to cause more suffering and death. Afif Nasuli is a journalist, but journalists are still barred from entering Gaza. Afif got in as an aid worker, and he will tell us what he experienced on today's show. Roughly a third of the 2.1 million people in Gaza have gone multiple days without food. More than 70,000 children under five and 17,000 pregnant and breastfeeding women are facing acute malnutrition across the Gaza Strip. They're often unable to seek medical care, as the few remaining hospitals struggle to operate without adequate supplies, personnel, or space, according to a new report from the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification. That's a UN-backed organization that tracks food security. Here is a report that ran on the UK's Channel 4 News yesterday.
So tiny, so frail. Baby Watine is 3 months old, but weighs less than when she was first born. Suffering as Gaza starves. Milk and diapers, her mother says. That's all I'm asking for my daughter. If she stays like this, I'm going to lose her. Watine's mother, like so many in Gaza right now, unable to breastfeed because of the lack of food. Around 90 children have died from hunger in Gaza during this conflict, many in the past 2 weeks. The most vulnerable, those suffering from other medical conditions. But doctors say Watine was born healthy.
There's a total loss of muscle. It's only skin on top of bones, which is an indication that the child has entered severe acute malnutrition.
Aid is being airdropped into Gaza now, and Israel is allowing more trucks in too. But the chaos on the ground means most are immediately looted by desperate people and criminals. The amount of food entering the territory is nowhere near enough to feed a desperate population that many allege Israel has deliberately chosen to starve.
That is a clip that ran on the UK's Channel 4 News yesterday. And here is Dr. Mohammed Abu Mugaisib, Doctors Without Borders medical coordinator in Gaza.
For the past months, I have been surviving actually on one meal per day. And in the last few days, I have even had only one meal every 2 days. Not because I cannot afford it, but there is nothing to buy, and the markets are completely empty. And I'm not the only one. We care for patients who are dying of hunger while we are ourselves starting to starve. Ambulance driver who transport the wounded and patients as well are starving. We are expected to save lives while our own are slowly being consumed. This is not just about hunger, but about slow destruction of life, dignity, and humanity. Here's how starvation destroys your body. In the first 6 to 24 hours, blood sugar drops. The body burns stored glycogen to stay alive. 1 to 3 days, no more glycogen. Fat is turned into ketones to fuel your brain. The body is now in a survival mode, we call it. From 3 to 5 days, the muscles start breaking down. The body sacrifices its own tissue, even the heart, just to survive. This is when children stop crying. This has to stop. I mean, to use food, water, AIDS as a weapon in this war, that's not acceptable at all.
That is Dr. Mohammed Abu Mugaisib, Doctors Without Borders medical coordinator in Gaza. Seeking aid has become deadly in Gaza. More than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed trying to access food, most near air distribution sites run by the Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, according to the UN Human Rights Office. Dr. Nick Maynard lives in the UK. He recently spent 4 weeks at Nasser Hospital in Gaza. He's volunteered in Gaza many times. Here he is on the UK's LBC Current Affairs show, describing his experience treating young people who were shot by Israeli forces.
I think the thing that shocked me the most by a long way was the targeting, the shootings of young teenage males, sometimes only 11 or 12 years of age, who were going to the food distribution points, the bizarrely named Gaza Humanitarian Foundation food distribution points, to get food for their starving families. And they were, many of them were shot, and I operate on many of them. And not only were they 11, 12, 13-year-olds being shot. One 12-year-old I operated on died on the table, on the operating table, because the injuries were so severe. But what was even more distressing was the very, very clear targeting of particular body parts on particular days. And what I mean by that is we saw clusters of injuries coming on particular days. So one day there'd be predominantly gunshot wounds to the head. The next day, there'd be gunshot wounds to the chest. The next day, gunshot wounds to the abdomen. And even on one day, 2.5 weeks ago, we saw four young teenage boys all brought in within an hour of each other, having been targeted and shot in the testicles, only the testicles. So the clustering of these injuries was so striking that it was beyond coincidence. And it made us feel that the Israeli soldiers who were carrying out this shooting was some sort of target practice or playing a game. So that was probably the single most disturbing thing I saw.
That was Dr. Nick Maynard talking about his recent trip to Gaza on the UK's LBC Current Affairs show. Dr. Maynard said that his American colleagues, the doctors who are volunteering in Gaza, are bringing formula with them to Gaza because it's desperately needed. But that formula was taken by Israeli authorities. So we've been doing so many shows about this for almost 2 years. What will it take to end the starvation, the death, and the destruction in Gaza? Today we are joined by three guests. Avril Benoit is CEO of Doctors Without Borders in the United States. Doctors Without Borders reports that after nearly 2 years of war and amid Israel's punishing siege, not a single hospital in the Gaza Strip is currently fully functional. Avril Benoit has worked with Doctors Without Borders since 2006. Hi, Avril. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Leslie Archambault is Managing Director of Humanitarian Policy for Save the Children. They report that after 20 months of war, the humanitarian aid system in Gaza is facing total collapse. With more than 930,000 children in Gaza, nearly every single child is now at risk of famine. They say this is not a food supply crisis. It is a crisis of access and lack of political will. Hi, Leslie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're joined by Afif Nesouli. Afif is a journalist and host of With Afif Nesouli. From March 27th to June 3rd, Afif was in Gaza as a humanitarian aid worker. His friends, colleagues, and sources in Gaza were fainting because they did not have enough to eat. He wrote about his experience for The Intercept with support from the Pulitzer Center and the Fund for Investigative Journalism. He writes, "Reporting from inside Gaza over the last few months, The Intercept observed a famine that is manufactured and an aid distribution system seemingly designed to cause more suffering and death. Amid the war, Israel has rendered Gaza inaccessible to the foreign press. Afif accessed the Strip by volunteering as an aid worker for a medical nonprofit and reporting in his off hours." Hi, Afif. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, Afif, can you tell us how you got in because journalists are still not allowed. They're prohibited by the Israeli government from going to Gaza. So you got in as an aid worker. How did you manage to do that?
Yeah, so I was reporting on someone with HIV in the north in Gaza city. And that meant that they were getting their medication mostly from the Ministry of Health, who knew that they had HIV, knew that they were queer. Something that's often underreported is that HIV positive people get their medication from the health ministry regularly. But amidst the genocide, it was getting harder and harder for this person to access their medication. Either depots were being destroyed. It just wasn't guaranteed. And they had reached out to me because I had been covering the genocide and covering all sorts of different types of people. And so I coordinated, so then GLIA, which was an organization that I ended up going to Gaza with, who works under the WHO, actually reached out to me and said, we've seen some of your posts on the internet and in various places about this person. We actually think we can help deliver a convoy of medication to them and just generally look, you know, sort of correspond with them. So I put them together and sort of covered their relationship for The Intercept, which ended up allowing me to sort of get to know what GLIA does, how they help people. And I offered them, you know, if there was a position open or a role that I could sort of fill, to let me know. And I was in Beirut for several months before and in Damascus doing my doing other reporting. And a role opened up, a logistics coordinator, which meant doing a lot of different things. And they asked me if I would be available to go to Gaza pretty soon. It was only a few weeks in all. So I had to travel to Amman, get cleared by GLIA, get cleared by the, you know, WHO and UN, and then eventually get cleared by Israel, who I guess didn't do the diligence work to figure out that I was also a reporter, because my capacity in Gaza was going to just be about volunteering and being an aid worker. I mean, there's a lot of Palestinian journalists who are doing a great job. So that's kind of the story in the fastest way possible.
And I just want to mention, we are seeing even just horrific videos and images coming out of Gaza. On Friday, July 25th, the New York Times had a horrific photo of a mother, Hedaya Al-Mutawak, holding her 18-month-old baby, Mohammed, in her arms. And he's just so thin. I mean, you can see the bones protruding out of his back. And it's important to remember that these photos are taken by Palestinian journalists who are also searching for food. In this case, Sahar Al-Ghora. Can you talk about this? I think it's really easy to forget that journalists are still not inside Gaza, and what we are seeing is coming from Palestinian journalists who've been taking these images and these videos for the last year and a half.
Yeah, I think it's really important to remember that from our phones, this is horrifying, but from within, in the enclave, like, I personally didn't have more than one meal a day. I was just didn't have access to that kind of those kind of supplies. We had to ration, and that was, I left Gaza June 3rd. So when I was there, I had lost 12 pounds in the 9 weeks that I'd been there because of just the lack of supplies and the lack of ability to eat when I wanted and, you know, or whatever I wanted. And then my colleagues, the journalists, the doctors, the nurses that are all local Gazawis, had lost a lot of weight by then. I had a friend, Basil, who worked for a community kitchen, who had lost nearly 85 pounds. Another friend was at 6 foot tall and 119 pounds. They'd lost so much weight since the genocide had begun. So you're talking about all of these people who are actively trying to support each other, whether they're, you know, that's what their job calls, or if they're just community members, families, parents. Everybody is suffering because there's not enough supplies. So everybody is kind of bearing the weight of their own personal bodies giving out on them, while also trying to tend to people who are already sick or have some harder condition to deal with that malnutrition makes worse. There was just such a reality check for me as a person who, you know, lives in New York and is more or less quite privileged, to just experience not having things on the market, or when there was fresh produce, how exorbitant the prices were given that there isn't cash. There's not much cash to spend. There's not much cash that any of us have. I personally couldn't bring in more than $280 into the enclave without Israel sort of confiscating it. So nobody has cash. I brought in my own tuna cans to mostly give away or subsist on. So it's really hard. There's not a lot of information. And it's really important that we do listen to Palestinians who really tell us the story months before we decide to publish in major media outlets.
Afif Nasuli is a journalist who got into Gaza recently as an aid worker. And tomorrow we are going to talk about a documentary called Gaza, Journalists Under Fire. It exposes Israeli forces killing over 200 Palestinian journalists. Today, we're also joined by Leslie Archambeau, Managing Director of Humanitarian Policy for Save the Children. I'm so sorry, Leslie. I completely forgot that you have to leave us in 10 minutes. We've had...
No worries. I can stay for a bit.
Okay, great. Thank you. We've had members of Save the Children on the show in the past, and you know, at the end of the day, what is it going to take to end all of this, to end the starvation, the death, and the destruction?
It feels like a simple answer, but it's the same thing we've been saying since day one. We need a definitive ceasefire. Children need a definitive ceasefire. Without it, we're still going to see continued waves of need, waves of death and destruction. There's not going to be any safe place for the more than 1 million children in the Gaza Strip. In the immediate, you know, we need an end to the siege, and it needs to be more than just words and statements. We need to actually see a flood of aid come in so that humanitarians can scale up and meet all the needs. It can't be just a trickle. It can't be, you know, just PR. We actually need to see this flooding of aid throughout the Gaza Strip. And we need safety throughout the Gaza Strip as well. Our staff, we have almost 200 staff currently in Gaza. Most of them are local. They are still showing up every day. They are suffering themselves, trying to find food for their families. And it is very dangerous oftentimes for us to be operating at all, because no matter how much we coordinate with Israeli authorities, you know, every day we're still seeing convoys and warehouses and trucks attacked. And these are you know, humanitarian supplies and vehicles that have already been noticed to the Israeli government. So we need a ceasefire at the end of the day. It needs to be definitive and long-lasting, but we also need, in the immediate, an end to the siege. We need deconfliction mechanisms to work, and that is that notification with the Israeli government so that humanitarians can actually operate. And we need to ensure that the grown-ups grow up a little, right? We need politicians to stop seeing people's lives as a bargaining chip. You know, these are children and their families. They are civilians, regardless of what international humanitarian law requires, and it absolutely requires their protection. You know, where is our humanity? Where is our morality? We can't use them as a bargaining chip in these discussions. They deserve and have a right to aid and to have their lives saved in the immediate. So I don't think any of that is easy, you know, but it's also not that hard. It's the same thing we've been saying over and over again. And I can tell you, Save the Children is over 100 years old. We operate in conflict zones around the world. And some of these things should not be this difficult. We should not still be having the same conversations around, you know, deconfliction and protecting humanitarian sites and protection of civilians. We should not continue to see attacks on trusted NGO and UN-led coordination systems that we work all over the world safely, securely, in principled ways. You know, we really do know how to provide aid. We know how to do it well. That was in Gaza. It was witnessed just a few months ago, or 6 months ago now. It feels like yesterday, when there was a pause in hostilities, when there was a ceasefire agreement. We can meet people's needs if the right conditions are in place. And the fact that we have to keep explaining this and keep arguing it is just, I mean, it's a bit infuriating. It's a bit frustrating, but it's also just completely heartbreaking for the children that we see suffer every day when we know we could prevent it.
Leslie Archambault is Managing Director of Humanitarian Policy for Save the Children. Avril Benoit is CEO of Doctors Without Borders in the United States. Avril, what would you like to add? What will it take to end all of this? At the very least, get food to people who desperately need it.
Well, I certainly would endorse everything that Leslie has said, and you'll hear that consistently from all the reputable humanitarian aid organizations that are working on the ground in Gaza. I guess what I would add, just given that for the first time we've heard the president acknowledge that people are starving in Gaza, but what he could do is really consider that the Israeli authorities that the U.S. has unconditionally always supported, funded with military aid, funded with so-called humanitarian aid, which I can explain in a second why I say so-called, but, you know, that the Israeli authorities are deliberately withholding food and clean drinking water as well. They are using starvation as a weapon of war. People have been hungry for months, and what's happening in Gaza is a choice to deprive people of food. It's not because there's a crop that's failed or a natural disaster. There are plenty of trucks just a few miles away that are ready to come in at scale. This is suffering that could end tomorrow if Israeli authorities allow food in at scale. And if U.S. officials, U.S. government, actually made them do so. And I'm really worried that with all this increased attention and the outrage and the recognition of what's actually happening, that the U.S. is just going to put more money into the GHF, this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which has done such a poor job. It was created by the U.S. and Israel. It's got a lot of private contractor mercenaries, really, and they are doing a disastrous and deadly job. People go to the few sites that they've set up, and they are shot, as we heard earlier from your clip. The GHF has to be dismantled and certainly never funded again. It has not been able to deliver food in a safe and effective way. And as a consequence, we're seeing not only increasing malnutrition because of this failed system, but all the injuries and deaths as a consequence of it. And seeking food when you're starving should not be punishable by death by security forces on the ground who shoot you when you are leaving the food distribution site. And this is what we're seeing over and over. So for me, the obviously there's a lot that Israel has to do, but it will only do it if it's got a lot of international pressure. And everyone around the world knows that the only real pressure is going to come from Washington, D.C.
Mm. From the Trump administration.
Yeah.
On the issue of food, I wanted you to respond to a New York Times piece that ran on July 26 by Natan Ottenheimer. He's reporting from Jerusalem. He writes, for nearly 2 years, Israel has accused Hamas of stealing aid provided by the UN and other organizations. The government has used that claim as its main rationale for restricting food from entering Gaza. But the Israeli military never found proof that the Palestinian militant group had systematically stolen aid from the UN. In fact, the Israeli military official said the UN aid delivery system, which Israel derided and undermined, was largely effective in providing food to Gaza's desperate and hungry population. This piece is called No Proof Hamas Routinely Stole UN Aid, Israeli Military Officials Say. What is your response to this, Avril?
We would, of course, see things the same way. There has been no credible evidence of the kind of diversion on a systemic level that Israeli authorities at the top political echelons are claiming. There's so much that they claim that is just not credible. And for us, the humanitarian groups, the UN mainly, that were carrying out food distributions for decades and doing so in Gaza and around the world, they do it without people getting shot. So Israel must fully lift this inhumane siege and stop lying to the public.
Would you like to add anything before we go to break, Leslie?
I agree completely with what Avril said. Save the Children has been in Gaza since the 70s. you know, in that entire time. We also are not seeing evidence of systematic aid diversion. That's not to say the looting that you referenced in the reporting at the top of the hour isn't happening. That is entirely a result of the lack of this flood of food that is needed. These are desperate people who are trying everything they can to feed themselves and their families. And that is not the same thing as systematic aid diversion. We have seen no evidence of it from our end. And as far as I am aware, Israel has not been able to provide any evidence of it. I can tell you that, you know, as I said a little earlier, Save the Children works with the UN and other humanitarian agencies in conflict zones all around the world. Aid diversion is, you know, it is something that we work to mitigate. We have processes in place. We have significant experience in how to mitigate risks and how to share information. And, you know, if there is something that we need to be doing differently, it needs to be a coordinated conversation. And that has not happened. There has not been any evidence shared. There has not been any attempt to fix it. If anything, we're just consistently restricting access more and more and creating more and more desperation. And the way that the Israeli authorities are controlling sort of the routes inside the Gaza Strip means that there's no chance for UN or humanitarian actors to deviate from the roads that they're allowed to go on. So even if there was a risk identified, it's not like we can change up our paths or our routes. It is very constrained. You can go on this road and only that road. And so I think that there's a lot of issues with that argument, that speculation, that rhetoric that we keep hearing repeated. And I don't think it's, you know, it's something that we need to be pushing back on. But at the end of the day, like, we need to get more food in. We need to you know, stop the desperation and save lives. And we can't let all of these other arguments constantly be distractions with all of that.
Leslie Archambault is Managing Director of Humanitarian Policy for Save the Children. Avril Benoit is CEO of Doctors Without Borders. Afif Nasuli is a journalist. From March 27th to June 3rd, Afif was in Gaza as a humanitarian aid worker. He wrote about his experience for The Intercept. He says his friends, colleagues, and sources in Gaza were fainting because they did not have enough to eat. We're getting a number of emails about last night's vote, and people would like to know which senators voted for this. So last night, the U.S. Senate voted down Bernie Sanders' resolution to ban U.S. arms sales to Israel. The vote was 70 to 27. All of the yes votes came from Democrats. I'll just read their names. Elsa Brooks, Baldwin, Blunt, Rochester, Duckworth, Durbin, Heinrich, Hirono, Kane, Kim, King, Klobuchar, Lujan, Markey, Merkley, Murphy, Murray, Sanders, Schatz, Shaheen, Smith, Van Hollen, Warnock, Warren, and Welch. The two senators in California, Padilla and Schiff, voted against the Bernie Sanders resolution, and then Slotkin, Gallego, and Kelly did not vote. And if you want to find that, we did link it on our website, kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Today, we are talking about what it will take to end the starvation, the death, and the destruction in Gaza. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about what it will take to end the starvation, death, and destruction in Gaza. And we just got a couple more emails about last night's vote. So yes, just to make it clear, people had questions about California Senators Alex Padilla and Adam Schiff. They voted against Bernie Sanders' resolution that would ban arms sales to Israel. So just to make that clear, Padilla and Schiff voted no. 24 Democratic senators voted yes, which is 12 more than last time. And then three Democrats did not vote. So just for the record, you can find the roll call on our website, kalw.org, click news, and then you can click on your call. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Avril Benoit is CEO of Doctors Without Borders. They report that after 2 years, nearly 2 years of war, not a single hospital in the Gaza Strip is currently fully functional. Leslie Archambault is Managing Director of Humanitarian Policy for Save the Children. They report that nearly every single child in Gaza, more than 930,000, are now at risk of famine. Afif Nasuli is a journalist who was in Gaza from March 27th to June 3rd. Israel still does not allow journalists to enter Gaza, but he got in volunteering as a humanitarian aid worker, and he wrote about his experience for The Intercept with support from the Pulitzer Center and the Fund for Investigative Journalism. I have another question. I'm wondering if any of you can add, based on what we know and based on all of the reporting that has come out. Mark writes, if Hamas turned over hostages and stopped embedding in the population and firing on the IDF, the food would get in. Would anyone like to take that and respond?
Yeah, I think that that's just a misconception of the logistics of what is going on here. Israel really does control every single thing coming in and coming out of Gaza. And also all of the coordination within Gaza is very overseen. I mean, there are drones everywhere. There are bombs falling all of the time. I think that the UN-backed system had 400 locations that delivered food to people. It went into red zones. It provided something that was necessary given the circumstances, which Israel controls. So it's basically the idea that a party that has a lot less control over anything would have an outsized amount of power over an entity that's like globally backed. It logistically and like factually doesn't make any sense. And also, I just didn't experience Hamas in Gaza the way that people think that they're operating there. And I didn't and haven't heard from any of my sources, and there are many of them, both on all sorts of walks of life, who do not experience that either, or else they would sort of talk about it very freely with me, because they do talk about their feelings about Hamas, whether positive or negative, mostly negative, often given just how bad it's gotten. And so this idea isn't true. It's not true because it's just structurally not true.
Can I add just another question there?
Yes, Avril.
So we have heard, if Hamas just released the hostages, this would all be over. So what you're essentially saying is that it's okay for Israel to hold all these children and civilians hostage in a campaign of starvation while you're waiting for Hamas to release the hostages that it took. I mean, you have to go through your logic there. And what we're always arguing is that Hamas committed crimes. It still commits crimes of holding hostages, and certainly it was a crime against humanity what happened on October 7th. That does not justify Israel committing genocide or committing crimes along the lines of collectively punishing all the civilians in Gaza, making life impossible for them, removing all the means of life by destroying civilian infrastructure, denying them food and water, denying them medicine. And also, let's not remember, it's not just food that they're blocking from entering Gaza at scale. It's also medical supplies, and it's also things like fuel. And why do we need fuel? We need it to run ambulances. We need it to run the electricity grid, because that was one of the first things that was destroyed after October 7th by Israel. We need fuel to run generators for hospitals to be able to run incubators. We need all the, even to deal with the malnutrition. You can't just dump grain upon the people from the sky in insufficient quantities and expect that that's going to turn things around, or allow a few trucks to enter and expect that that will make much of a dent, because it really doesn't give everybody enough nutrition to begin with. You need the medicines that are therapeutic medicines specifically intended to help people recover from malnutrition. Because you can't, you also, when you've got a malnourished child, food alone no longer works. Mm. People need to be closely monitored by a medical professional who's providing therapeutic foods. And this is another thing that Israel is denying to those who are malnourished in Gaza right now.
Leslie, we have to let you go in a couple of minutes. Just based on what Avril said, I wanted to ask you about the long-term consequences of this for children. Wired just came out with a piece called The Grave Long-Term Effects of the Gaza Malnutrition. The WHO believes 1 in 5 children in Gaza are acutely malnourished, with the health effects potentially lasting for generations. What can you tell us about this?
I think that's absolutely right. You know, it's about saving their lives in the immediate, but even if we save their lives in the immediate, we cannot, that will not negate the damage done to their development. Children's brains are still being developed. They're still growing. And malnutrition at a young age, it has lifelong impacts. In addition, though, to the malnutrition, I think we would be really remiss if we didn't mention all of the other massive long-term impacts that children are experiencing right now. They have not had any formal education in almost 2 years. They are experiencing and witnessing violence and anxiety and bombs and blood on a daily basis. And that kind of trauma to children also has a physical impact on them. We are, you know, seeing children in our child-friendly spaces who are literally wishing for death, so that they can, you know, be with their parents in heaven, so that they can have love and food and water, and just some peace. You know, we are doing case management work with children who have first lost their parents, and then they've lost their foster parents, who have been killed over and over again, being displaced over and over again. And this is a formative experiences for children. I think the recovery that is needed, so the immediate trauma, first aid and psychological first aid that is needed, the immediate protection services so that these children who keep losing caregivers are in some sort of safety. This is not an easy solution. It's not an easy fix. You know, we're seeing diseases and it pop up that because of lack of vaccinations, because of lack of clean water, all of these things compounded. So the malnutrition piece is getting a lot of attention right now and is absolutely critical, and we need to get food in. We really do need to be focusing, though, on all of these other needs that children have, on the medical care, on the psychosocial care, on making sure they have some form of education and learning. All of these things will impact them in the immediate, but also their long-term and their hope for living. And it's really just, it's unbelievably, the impacts that they're experiencing, the things that they're telling us, it's just, I keep saying heartbreaking, and I don't feel like that's enough. It is hard to hear some of these stories that we're getting from children every day, and, you know, from their parents. I think all of that needs to be paid attention to, and it's not, and this is why we're saying there needs to be a flood of aid in. It's the food aid, but it's also everything else needs to get in. The medical care and medical equipment and shelter and hygiene kits, and making sure that we have the right technical experts on the ground who can support children and their psychosocial needs and specific medical needs.
And Leslie, right before we let you go, it's so important to remember that we're not talking about a hard-to-reach remote part of the world. I remember last year hearing an Israeli peace activist say, "We're not that far from Gaza. Tel Aviv is about 45 miles from Gaza."
Yeah, it's, I mean, I've been to Gaza. It is, the longest part of getting in is getting through all the security, and it's right there. There are, you know, a few miles away. There is the food that is needed. There's the aid that is needed. Save the Children has not been able to get in any aid ourselves since March 2nd. We've got 50 trucks waiting, all with things tailor-made for children. We've got more supplies and warehouses in Jordan and Egypt and the West Bank, and all of that can be there immediately. We can deploy it right away. We can help these children and start getting them, you know, back to the road to the recovery. It is, you know, I think has been said several times throughout this conversation, it is a political choice to deny this, to make children suffer, to let them continue to suffer and see this damage to them. And I'm just shocked that we can still sort of turn our backs on this after everything that we're seeing.
Leslie Archambault is Managing Director of Humanitarian Policy for Save the Children. They report that every single child in Gaza, over 930,000 children, are now at risk of famine. Leslie, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and really for your continued focus and attention on this crisis. It's really appreciated.
Thank you. And joining us for the rest of the hour is Avril Benoit, CEO of Doctors Without Borders in the United States. They report that not a single hospital in the Gaza Strip is currently fully functional. Afif Nasuli is a journalist. From March 27th to June 3rd, Afif was in Gaza as a humanitarian aid worker. His friends, colleagues, and sources were fainting because they just didn't have enough to eat. He wrote about his experience for The Intercept. Israel still prohibits journalists from entering Gaza, but Afif was able to go in as an aid worker. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for holding.
Yes, hi. I am 65 years old and the grandson of a Holocaust survivor from the Dachau concentration camp in Germany. And unlike what Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries said some time ago and on TV, that we stand with Israel. No, the base does not stand with Israel. Again, as the grandson of a Holocaust survivor, I've never been so outraged with my elected leaders for misrepresenting our interests, their base. The fact that we have given Israel $298 billion, and what have we gotten for it? And this is Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu are modern-day Hitlers. And I look at the AIPAC tracker, and I see why Adam Schiff voted nay. Apparently, as of July 8th of last year, Adam Schiff had received $6 million in support from AIPAC from the Israeli lobby for his campaign last year. $6 million. They're bought and corrupt, and I'm just disgusted. And I'm going to write them today to let them know my opinion. And I am not anti-Jewish. I'm anti-Israel. Because of what they're doing in our name, and we are doing, our elected leaders are doing nothing but support this atrocity, this daily despicable. I've just never seen anything like it, and it's a modern day Holocaust. And the fact that Nancy Pelosi, a devout a Catholic and grandmother, how does she sleep at night? Jill and Joe Biden, how do they sleep at night? And Adam Schiff and Alex Padilla, same thing. They're not representing us. They're representing their own interests by working for Israel and not their democratic base.
Kevin, thank you so much for calling in. I just want to mention a piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. This ran on July 11th, and we're trying to get these reporters on the show: Patrick Kingsley, Ronan Bergman, and Natan Ottenheimer. They have a piece called How Netanyahu Prolonged the War in Gaza to Stay in Power. Secret meetings, altered records, ignored intelligence, the inside story of the prime minister's political calculations since October 7th. They report that 6 months into the war, Netanyahu was preparing to bring it to a halt. Negotiations were underway for an extended ceasefire with Hamas. He was ready to agree to a compromise. And then they write about how the proposal on the table would have paused the war in Gaza for at least 6 weeks. More than 30 hostages would have been released. There's just so much in here. They write, but for Netanyahu, a truce came with a personal risk. He led a fragile coalition that deepened on the support of far-right ministers who wanted to occupy Gaza, and he was vulnerable. He'd been standing trial for corruption. So this is a really long story, and we're trying to get these reporters on the air to find out what they found, because it's just important to put all of these pieces together. And you just reminded me of that piece. So thank you for calling in. We're getting a number of emails, Afif, who want to know, given that outside journalists are not allowed into Gaza, can you just tell us more about what your experience was like? I mean, you have a video of these drones that are flying overhead on a regular basis. What are you hearing from people on the ground? What are they saying to you about what's happening? How are they even surviving this?
I think I just wanted to comment on what this caller was talking about and just mention that to me and to them, to the sources that I brought up, this is really a story about capital. And it's very important to understand that the main character of this entire situation when you're there really are the weapons and how loud they are and how destructive they are and how scary it all is, because you are walking around with a buzz, a low hum sometimes, and then sometimes it's a very loud hum of drones sort of surveilling you, some quadcopters having weapons on them. Ultimately, it makes you sort of believe that all of this is about, you know, an elite class trying to forward some agenda that, of course, I can't speak on because I can't speak on their intentions, but it becomes very clear that a lot of this is about sort of clearing a piece of land so that, you know, Israel can expand and that Israel can sort of keep its agenda of expansion going through different means, various means of eradication. And so now I think from what I'm hearing from my sources, my colleagues, even just my friends, is this sense of real sort of doom. They're starving. I mean, imagine not having eaten something for 2 days and then having to like figure out all sorts of your daily tasks that would even occur in a genocide, from just living in a tent that you've been displaced several times by the time it's, you know, July 2025. So many people have been displaced so many times. They're with either ailing parents or kids. There are big communities. People are surviving by leaning on each other and by being very faithful and thankful all of the time. In fact, I was very, very, very aware, acutely aware of how psychologically disciplined and capable everybody is because they are so faithful. And not all of them are religious per se. It's just an amount of faith in each other and faith in the larger, more meaningful story of their sort of destiny. And I think that that's how they are fighting this most of all, is that by really having so little, you are leaning on each other to protect one another. I mean, it is literally a dystopian battle zone, it's just a battlefield of death everywhere and hunger everywhere. A lot of my experiences were in hospitals and documenting nurses and doctors who were working on people who had explosive injuries and didn't have enough supplies to even help them get any sort of health care. A lot of my time there was spent just coordinating things from one place to another. And sometimes taking a 20-minute drive would mean 5 hours trying to get a green light. So a lot of this to me that gets doesn't get brought up a lot is that this is really about an elite class of the world versus a very, very, very small and vulnerable population being accused of stuff that is not fair. And it's not an accident that all of this is happening. We call to stop it, but I think there is this element of intention happening here that I think is important to remember, is that you wouldn't be starving children or people unless you really, really hoped that there was something about this population that could be eradicated or moved or I guess genocided, to put it pretty frankly. So what I experienced there was something that imbued me with a lot of sort of perspective on how we speak about what's going on and how we give a lot of room for a lot of lies and really, really do not listen to Palestinians when they speak and they tell us what's going on. And right now what they're saying is that there is a starvation that they're experiencing that they cannot survive, and it is on purpose.
To your point about the weapons, Axios reports that last night's Senate bill or resolution would have blocked $675 million in Israeli arms and weapons. We're talking about 5,000 bombs, tens of thousands of assault rifles. Final thoughts from you, Avril. What are you hearing from your colleagues in Gaza? I played that clip from Dr. Mohammed Abu Mukhasib, who talked about how he's got money to buy food, but there's no food to buy, and it's so expensive. So in our final moments, What would you like to share about what you're hearing from your colleagues in Gaza?
Well, what is certainly incredible to me is that even though they are hungry themselves, eating every second day, maybe one small meal, they are still showing up day after day to heal the wounded and provide life-saving medical care. Doctors Without Borders has about 1,000 Palestinian colleagues in Gaza, and they're complemented by roughly 35 international medical workers who rotate in and out. And in the midst of malnutrition crisis, a famine perhaps, we don't know for sure because we can't do the full sampling of the entire population with all the insecurity, we're seeing an increase of medical needs. We're seeing our most experienced war doctors, trauma surgeons, saying they're seeing horrific injuries with children whose entire faces have been peeled off from explosions and bombings and multiple amputations. We've got thousands of children who have amputated limbs. Patients are covered in third-degree burns. So with all the airstrikes, everything that's going on in addition to preventing people from having access to the basics like food and water and medicines and the fuel for electricity and all the rest, we have an ongoing traumatic medical situation. And I just find it commendable, and I'm so filled with respect and admiration for all the aid workers there and the journalists who are showing up above and beyond, really, to not only try to help people, but to tell the story.
Avril Benoit is CEO of Doctors Without Borders in the United States. They have found that not a single hospital in the Gaza Strip is currently fully functional. Avril, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Anytime.
Afif Nasuli is a journalist. From March 27th to June 3rd, Afif was in Gaza as a humanitarian aid worker. Israel is still prohibiting journalists from entering Gaza. He was able to get in as an aid worker. He wrote about his experience for The Intercept, and you can find it at klw.org, click news, and then your call. Afif, thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate you having us on today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.